This is our second week of stewardship time, the whole month of October this year. And so we continue talking through the five unifying principles that the church adopted in June. Last week, we talked about the first one, which goes, we are generous to others because God's generosity empowers us. They're all printed in that goldenrod insert I checked, so you can read up if you want to study up on these things, which in case that's more interesting than the sermon. This week, we talk about the second of these. I'm taking them a little out of order. This one goes, Jesus' love inspires us to advocate for peace and justice wherever Christ guides us. I modified it to fit the lectionary readings a little better, so it's listed third where you're doing it second. Hope that's okay. I find this principle of the five to be perhaps the most aspirational, which is to say, while I think we do work for peace and justice in this congregation, I don't think we usually frame the work in those terms. And I'm not sure how much of the work that we do qualifies as advocacy per se. So I think it's a unifying principle worth exploring. Now, before we get too far into that, I need to tell you about my week. Because I'm the preacher and I can tell you about my week if I want to. Over the course of 3 days, I put about 1,500 miles on my car and 24 hours of actual driving time. I did this, as many of you saw on Facebook, I think, to attend the funeral of my former Lutheran Volunteer Corps housemate, Maggie. Maggie had become a pastor in Minnesota, and so her funeral was filled with people I knew from over the past 20 years of my life, people I'd gone to undergrad with, just 50 miles from there, people that I went to the seminary with in Chicago, where Maggie also was at the time, my housemates that I was able to sit with, and we all helped lead the funeral. A packed house. There were tables for the luncheon in every open available space in the building, like in the hallways of the basement and everything. It was full. Maggie was having a routine gallbladder surgery, they say, and then the language is that they nicked an artery, which I've come to learn is a bizarre euphemism for minimizing the impact of a medical mistake that kills an otherwise healthy 37-year-old woman. Nicked an artery. But I digress. Maggie leaves behind her loving husband and two children, ages 8 and 4. And the enduring image of this week for me will always be that of Maggie's 4-year-old son, who, just as we were lining up outside to process in, it was the leaders of the service, which included my housemates and I, and then the family, and then all the pastors trailing back into the depths of the building. There were at least 70 pastors there, I'm sure. Anyway, as we were lined up, this 4-year-old was up front, and he broke free and ran the long aisle to the front of the worship space, where there was a nice big picture of his mother. And so he stayed up there for a minute. It was time to start, so his father had to go walk up the long aisle and get him. And he carried him back, squirming and squawking the whole way. Oh boy, what did I do? Oh, that's what I did. Okay, I printed this wrong. What's going on here? So, his father walked the long, slow aisle and picked him up and carried him back, squawking and squirming. And when he got back, this kid had a full-on, laying on the floor right next to me, full-on tantrum, you know, banging his fists on the ground and kicking his feet and just yelling, I want to see my mommy! And I, you know, tears streaming down my face, and everybody around me was crying, and we all sort of turned to each other at the same time and said, I wish I could be doing what he's doing. He's the one doing the right thing. The rest of us felt really out of place when this 4-year-old was able to express what we all felt in that moment. Then we all processed in and did a funeral. I did a lot of crying this week. To and from, well, in my driving, the only music I listened to was that of Tom Petty, which is surprisingly excellent music for a road trip across the Midwest, unless you know the music of Tom Petty, in which case it's not surprising at all that it's such excellent music for a road trip across the Midwest. The days that I was not traveling and focused on this funeral this week, the beginning of the week, I was, well, besides frantically trying to squeeze in a week's worth of work into a day and a half, I was also spent quite a bit of time worrying about and talking online about the shooting in Las Vegas last weekend. not sure I have anything useful to say about that, but that was, I mean, that was kind of how the, that was just how the week was for a lot of people, and me among them. Somehow my roommate's funeral fit right in with the theme of the week, unfortunately. So, you know, seeing the commentary about this shooting on Facebook, you know, of course you had the people, you had the people advocating for restricted gun ownership, you had those asserting the sovereign right to unlimited individual gun ownership. And in the midst of all that, I couldn't help but think of today's gospel lesson, the parable that Jesus tells. The landowner leasing his vineyard, and the tenants deciding to take the vineyard for themselves by force. So they beat and killed and stoned the servants sent to collect the produce. How ironic that the landowner had built a fence and a watchtower to protect his vineyard. And then he populated his vineyard with the people from whom it needed protection, it turns out. Finally, the text says, he sent his son to them, saying, they will respect my son. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, this is the heir. Let us kill him and get his inheritance. Jesus was talking about his own life and death, of course, and he goes on to condemn the chief priests and the Pharisees with whom he is speaking, comparing them to the tenants who have lived off the generosity of the landowner and stolen what did not belong to them. Remember that this parable comes just after Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem in the last week of his life. The religious authorities have challenged him in gospel readings we've heard in previous Sundays, and this antagonistic dialogue will continue for another couple of weeks. So if you come back to here or any other lectionary church, you're going to hear more of these potentially violent parables in which Jesus is all but picking a fight with the religious authorities in Jerusalem. In light of the violence in Las Vegas, of the death that happened there, this parable reminds us where Jesus stood in relation to violence. Jesus was the victim. Jesus did not advocate violence or even retaliation. Only a few days later in Jesus' life, as he is being arrested, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus says it this way, put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Jesus today, as then, stands or falls with the victims of violence, as he always has, taking their side against a world bent on self-justifying murder. When we talk about advocating for peace and justice, which is a tricky thing, we do so in remembrance of Jesus, and we do so by following his example. We advocate for peace and justice with boldness, as Jesus did. Jesus told this parable in Jerusalem directly to the religious authorities whose power he was challenging by telling it. He was basically making an elaborate joke in their face, in front of not just them, but the whole crowd, so that they couldn't do anything about it. Because if they had turned on him, as it says at the end of the lesson, if they had turned on him in that moment, the crowd would have taken Jesus' side. There was nothing they could do. It reminds me of one time I saw two very powerful elected officials from two different parties, and they had to get up and stand up next to each other and give speeches about Martin Luther King Day. And one of them took the opportunity to really, really subtly savage the other one's party. And the other one had to just stand there and take it. And then, because of the way the crowd was aligned, that person did not have the opportunity to retaliate in kind, because that would not have gone well. It was an interesting moment. And that's Jesus talking to these religious authorities. He knew very well that they would want to kill him for what he said. He knew very well that his words would have consequences, serious consequences, and yet he was not afraid. He said the thing that God had called him to say. Jesus continued to preach God's peace and justice for those who stood under the thumb of Roman occupation and imperialism, and for those under the stratified religious social order of Jerusalem. When we advocate for peace and justice, we do so knowing that there will be consequences, knowing that the systems we challenge will exact a cost from us. And that's partly why it's so hard to do that. It's much easier to remain in the comfort of our own homes, to recognize that issues that don't affect me directly, it would just be safer and easier for me to stay home and not speak out. In that spirit, let's talk for a minute about firearms. You're going to hate this. Not all of you, most of you. In conversations this week, those who advocated for unlimited firearm ownership consistently returned to self-defense as a reason to own firearms. My right to gun ownership is a clear extension of my right to self-defense, the standard argument goes, and I think it's a very reasonable argument. Certainly one I've heard before. This week I was thinking a little differently about this argument because, you know, a firearm is a tool designed to kill. I mean, designed to kill an animal or a person, but it's, I mean, that's its point. Like, it's designed to cause injury, to kill. It's not like a car, which happens to kill people a lot, as a byproduct of its intended purpose, which of course is transportation. And so I thought about what the right of self-defense looked like when you have a gun versus what it looks like when you don't have a gun. So I'm not a gun owner. I hunted when I was a kid, but I was bad at it. And it became clear that I should be nowhere near firearms for the safety of myself and others. I have some somewhat humorous stories about that, but I'll leave that for another time. Let's just say I learned that this is not for me. So when I assert the right to my self-defense, which I do, I have the right to self-defense. I mean, what practically does that look like? I'm sitting in my house thinking about this. Does it look like, I mean, what am I going to hit somebody over the head with a frying pan? And what I determined is that for me, the right of self-defense basically tops out at the level of Kevin McAllister in Home Alone. So you've seen the movie Home Alone from 20 whatever years ago now. And that kid, I mean, he sets up nails and they put their foot in the nails and they slip on the ice and fall on the stairs again and again, which is hilarious. He has the thing where some contraption where it like starts a fire on Joe Pesci's hat and he's like, oh, and his hat's on fire. That's the one I remember always the best. Or the irons that are somehow hot, they swing down the stairs and hit Daniel Stern right in the face. You know, like that's pretty much the self-defense that I could maybe muster if I had the time and inclination. You know, it's comical almost in those terms, obviously. But when you introduce a firearm into the self-defense situation, then yes, all of a sudden becomes, and certainly the guys in Home Alone should have died a little bit too, but like if you introduce a firearm into a self-defense situation, then what you're saying is that death is definitely on the table here. If you assert the right to self-defense with a firearm, you are asserting the right to say, I can decide when it's the right time to kill another person. That's what you're saying. And I'm not making a condemning moral judgment about that. I'm just stating the fact that if you choose to defend yourself with a deadly weapon, then you've taken on the responsibility of potentially causing death. That's the choice you've made. And I think it's worth it for us to let the weight of that decision be part of the decision that we make. So certainly I'm not saying people don't have a right to self-defense. Don't mishear me. I'm just saying that if you do so with a gun, you've chosen to take someone else's life into your hands, to pass judgment and to potentially carry out a sentence of death in that moment. And maybe that's the right thing to do in a situation. It's possible. But as we follow Jesus, we don't find much biblical precedent for the killing of other people on our own, of our own volition, by our own choice. You shall not kill is one of the big ones. You've heard that one before. Another one that comes up again and again, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Written in the law, quoted in both Romans and Hebrews to remind Christians that it is God who judges and God who punishes, that life and death are to be left in God's hands and not our own. So from that uncomfortable place, we will return for a moment to our unifying principle. When we advocate for peace and justice, we do so with humility because ultimately we stand under the same judgment as those we feel are interrupting peace and perpetuating injustice. If any of us find ourselves in a position to make a life or death decision, the Christian response ultimately is to act, not out of fear, but to not just be paralyzed either. We need to do something, to do our best in the moment, recognizing that our best might be the wrong decision. We all make mistakes. Everybody sins. And the sins of taking up firearms might be a little bit, well, have some more serious consequences than the sin of trying to stand in condemnatory judgment over those with whom we disagree. But all of those things are the purview of God, not of us. And so when we act, when we try to advocate for peace and justice, when we go out and make a stand and are willing to upset people, we have to acknowledge that we might be wrong, that we might not have God's interests at heart in that moment. It can happen to any of us. And when this happens, all we can do, all any of us can do, is to throw ourselves completely on the mercy of God. And that's ultimately the lesson of all of the scriptures and of all of the stories of Jesus, that we throw ourselves completely on God's mercy. We know that we cannot justify ourselves, that we cannot ultimately save ourselves, that we cannot earn our righteousness through correct action or behavior or thought or belief or whatever else. All we can do is recognize our need for God's mercy and forgiveness, and to ask God for that mercy and forgiveness. And we can trust that God will grant mercy and forgiveness. We all want to see ourselves as the good guys or the heroes of a story, to sort of accidentally quote the children's sermon. We all want to believe our cause is just and our opinion is sound and well thought out, and we all want to, I mean, at least all of us who are on Facebook, we all want to stick it to people we don't agree with, at least sometimes. Try to keep me off Facebook, please. The good news is that God forgives us, all of us, no matter how much we might resemble the wicked tenants, or no matter how much we might resemble the self-righteous Pharisees. It is Jesus' audience that claims that all will be put to death. And Jesus does, he doesn't go easy on them, but he also doesn't explicitly affirm that death is what they will receive. This is the part that we call law. You've maybe heard me talk about it before. The good news is that law is not the end of the story, but in the death and the resurrection of Jesus, we can trust in God's forgiveness and mercy. We don't have to have all the answers. We don't have to be correct. And we can't be all the time. But we can still advocate for peace and justice in our way as best we know how, trusting in God's mercy, listening humbly to those around us so that we can be corrected when we shoot our mouths off in an unhelpful way. This parable points us to the mercy of God for us, and to our need for that mercy. Thanks be to God. Amen.